Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today, I'm really excited to be sitting down and having a chat with Alexandra Jabba, who is a paramedic and the creator of Emergency Resilience. Now, today we're going to be going over a really important topic, and that is death communication or breaking bad news. Now, this is something that a lot of us as paramedics, nurses don't get trained on. And when I had to do this first time, it was incredibly daunting. You don't know what to say, what to really do, and you wonder afterwards if you've done the right thing. However, the quality of our death notification can have a huge impact on the patient's family going forward and the way that they process grief. So we're going to talk today about sort of death notification training and how we can approach it going forward. So thanks so much for jumping on today, Alex. I would like for you to just introduce yourself a little bit more to our listeners as well, if that's all right.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate your invite to just have this conversation with your audience, with any students that you might attract, even new grads, anybody, honestly, because I think this is such an important topic. And I love working with students. I taught for a number of years, my paramedic students. I teach much less than I used to my paramedic students, but any chance I have to really get involved with them, I get definitely very excited. They are arguably my favorite population of, you know, our EMS world. But a little about myself, I worked in the EMS field on an ambulance for about 15 years. You kind of lose track of it after some time, before I had a pretty severe back injury. And that took me about a couple of years to recover from that. I was given the green light to go back into the field. By then, my life had taken a different direction. And I was teaching primarily. I'd already started teaching, luckily. So I had that option established. And I started working as what we refer to as an EMS coordinator. So I started working for fire departments that had EMS services and teaching and all those sort of reviews and whatnot. And I kind of just decided I wanted to, I found all the things we were teaching to be very important, but I wanted to kind of push the envelope, to kind of push what our standard was. I found a lot of our CE programs to be very monotonous, routine, you know, just kind of check the box. And I thought, you know, especially as I started studying mental health and psychology for my graduate programs, I realized there was such an element missing to the clinical skills that we learn. And I wanted to find a way to put these lessons into opportunities to get CEs for them. And I created a business, Emergency Resilience. I travel, go do classes. I create training for different departments. But I do have one class that's online. My goal is to have more. I've been telling people that as I'm getting really antsy to start creating more, but I've been finishing my PhD program. And so that had to come first. And as that's coming to a close and I graduate, there will be more to come. But the class that I think, you know, in my work that got your attention was my class on death communication, which is kind of this holistic approach to how do we communicate with people when their loved one has died? Because I don't think it's not as simple as following an algorithm script. There's so many different factors. I've been there on both ends, both receiving and delivering and avoiding. Plenty of avoidance. I was not naturally good at this. And that's the thing I want to make abundantly clear. But I learned from a lot of mistakes and I try and take those lessons and formulate them for other people to learn from.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. And I love that because you say, you know, you learned from all of your mistakes and you're trying to communicate that now. And I think that's fantastic because that's what partially this job's been, you know, you do a lot of on the job training and take the learnings as you go. And this is something that, I mean, the first time I ever had to do this as a new paramedic and break the bad news to a family or about their loved one, it was completely daunting. I had no idea what to do or if I was doing it correctly, if I was saying the right things, because it's not something that we necessarily get trained on. And the fascinating thing is listening to a podcast by the Resource Room about breaking bad news, because this is what sparked my interest when I first had to do it. I then listened in and tried to learn more about it and research, and then I found you on Instagram, and that's the thing. Like, they talk about the quality of the death notification having such a huge impact on that family of that patient and how they go forward with their grieving and their bereavement, but also the fact that it has a massive toll on paramedics and emergency workers, and particularly burnout, which I thought was incredibly important to understand and know about. So if you wanted to go into a little bit more about that and sort of how we can start taking this into like death notification training and I guess how we start to approach this and why we should be looking at it as something that's a crucial point of our career and our training.
Well, I think that personally, as my philosophy is that awareness usually is a great, it's an essential foundation to knowledge and education. And a lot of people don't understand and don't even recognize that, wow, we don't get taught this, or it's not our job. Like a lot of, you know, where I worked for several years, we, unless you were DOA, we were off scene within 10 minutes. So our opportunities to manage the family and deal with the family were minimal. And it became more progressive. I don't know where we're at nationwide as far as staying on scene and not transporting active CPR, but especially prior to COVID, this was the exception. It was not the norm. It wasn't something we always did. And so even the area that I ran in, it was only a year or two before where they started saying, hey, avoid transporting an active CPR. If you have no changes after 20 to 30 minutes, call it. And yet there was nothing that said what we were supposed to do with anybody else, you know? So there was a lot of pushback. There was a lot of avoidance. There were a lot of people that just didn't feel comfortable with it. And of course, you know, some of the higher ups that are too disconnected from the field were like, you're fine. Like, this shouldn't be a problem. This is something we always do, you know, and kind of just assumed. And I think when we step back and actually realize, number one, it is our job. Number two, we can actually make that family member's day better. And I say that very carefully, because it's still going to be one of the worst days of their life, depending, you know, there's a difference between losing, you know, 90-year-old grandma who died peacefully in her home and a 3-month-old, you know, SIDS, way different, right? But at the very least, can we do what we can? Is there more that we can do to make that experience, make them feel more supported, make them feel like they had closure, make them feel like they were just taken care of when nothing else could be done? And the answer is absolutely yes. That is our job. And the reason why it's more our job than anybody else is, I mean, of course, it's still going to be an important role for nurses and doctors to take on in the hospital, but we're there. We're the ones that go to their homes. We are the ones that show up at the peak of that crisis. And we have a tremendous influence on their grieving process, but we're just not aware of it. And so my argument when some people say, well, that's not our job, is whether we agree with that or not does not change the fact that it very much is our job, especially in areas that are utilizing high performance CPR, that are not transporting right away, that are remaining on scene until they get pulses back. It is absolutely our job. And it's our institutions that have failed to recognize this and mandate and implement standardized training. And so that was really my, I guess, push to create it. And I had a lot of hesitations. I thought to myself, well, there's a lot smarter, higher credentialed, more experienced people that aren't saying this. Am I missing something? You know, am I missing something? And it's starting to gain some traction, and I appreciate it, because I don't intend to be the only one that's doing this. But my philosophy essentially is that we need to be talking about death every time CPR is practiced, period. If it's a hands-only CPR class for the layperson, they need to know that they can do everything right and the patient still dies, and that's okay. That's not their fault. They gave them the best chance possible by intervening very courageously. If we're talking a basic life support class, if we're talking an ACLS class, if we're talking mega code in medic school or retraining, you know, every 2 years, it has to be a part of it. So long as 90% of our patients are still dying, despite all the advancements, why are we spending almost 0% of our time in training on that very realistic outcome?
Yeah, when you put it like that, the fact that we put so much of our training and I guess our identity of being in emergency services on that 10%, it fails to see where that training for the 90% is. And I went through uni and I don't even think we did a death notification in a CPR, a cardiac arrest scenario. It's just really interesting when you bring it up like that, the fact that we put so much training into only 10% and neglect the other 90%.
And I want to backtrack a little bit and ask you, how long was your training at university where you went?
Mine was 4 years for a double in nursing and paramedics.
So where I'm from, and I know this isn't all of the United States, but it is the majority of it, I was on the road within a year. I came in as an EMT with a lot of experience, but nonetheless an EMT. And by the end of that year, I was licensed and starting to apply for jobs. So there was always this kind of understanding or this idea that we just don't have time for it, right? We have to pack a lot of, and especially as I started teaching, I've been teaching at the college level of an EMS program for about eight plus years, very intensively. And as of late, a little less than I used to, but we have so much we have to cover in such a short amount of time. I mean, they get us for 16 to 20 weeks before going out into clinicals. And when students get devastated because they don't pass that 16 weeks, I'm like, you can't even get past, you can't make a baby in that long. Like, this is not that much time, guys. Like, I know you feel like this is your whole life right now, but this is such a little amount of time that we get you. And we have so much to go over. And so this attitude was always that we just didn't have time to do it. And so as I started networking with paramedics from around the world, and finding out that your 4 and 6 year programs don't go over this either, that was enough to confirm my bias. I was like, okay, I'm not wrong. We are avoiding this. And I had this epiphany, and this was during paramedic school. In hindsight, I remember thinking, and I had fantastic preceptors. I had great, great instructors. I had great professors throughout. I went to a great school. And I had an incredible internship. And I remember having that moment and realizing, oh, nobody taught my preceptors how to do this either. Nobody taught my teachers how to do this. This is why nobody taught me, because nobody taught them either. And so I'm positive that this comes from a place of avoidance. It comes from a place of discomfort with death. And it comes from a cultural, just, I don't know what the word I'm looking for here is, but just culturally, we have accepted that if we're not training on the intervention and we are not training on the interception of death, then we're not doing the patient justice, or we're not doing enough for them. But the reality is, there comes a point where, yes, all our attention should be on the patient and the family kind of gets lower acuity, right? But as the time goes on and they stay in asystole and their end tidal doesn't go up, guess what? Their priorities shift. And you know what? If we really want to do what's best for the patient, you know what they would love us to do? Take care of their family.
The problem in this and not having the training in it means that if you're constantly questioning yourself as a clinician of, did I say that right? Did I approach that correctly? Is this right? Is that right? You know, I can see where that burnout comes from and where those stats yes. come from, which was mind blowing reading it. And you go, that makes sense now.
Yeah, there was, I think you're referring to the study that was published in, I want to say it was 2021, but they found that paramedics that delivered 5 or more death notifications in a 12-month period had a had an astronomically higher risk of burnout. I think it was like 70 some percent. I'm blanking on the numbers right now, but it was extremely high. And what they found was that the antidote to that, so the cure for that, was training. And not just initial training as a paramedic student, but continuous training was found to significantly reduce that risk. And for me, looking back on my time on an ambulance where I could see that coming up and contributing to burnout is this, like you said, this self-doubt. Did I do that right? You know, sitting with me. And I think a lot of times when I think about the calls that followed me home, it wasn't always the traumatic ones. It was the ones where I felt like I didn't do my best. And I'm ruminating and I'm questioning and I'm replaying everything that went over and wondering, man, that sounds so stupid. Or I wish I wouldn't have said that. Or I wish I would have done, you know, something differently. And the reality is that our avoidance of some of these things, while they are being done so as a way to protect ourselves, I did that. I avoided the family because it was, I didn't know how to do it. So I just avoided it altogether. Is just as toxic. It'll work in the short term, but denying ourselves of that doesn't make it go away. It just suppresses it to come out later. And I think that's what this study was kind of touching on. And the remarkable thing about this study is that the data was collected years prior. I think, and I don't know exactly the dates, you'd have to go back and look, but because this was published post like the peak of COVID, you know, 2020, and then the winter of, I think, 2021, or whatever it was. But anyways, there's this assumption that, oh, well, you know, of course they were burning out because of COVID, but this data was collected before we had a pandemic. So imagine how much worse it probably is now that people were doing this day in and day out with all the other stressors that came with having a global pandemic. You know, like, it's just, it blows my mind when I think about it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And even the fact that it only takes, what they said, 5 death notifications. I think of that and I think I've done probably 6 or 7 in the past month, you know, like, it's just, that's crazy when you think about it. Doesn't take long, really. And I'd love to pick your brain about what your approach is and what you sort of teach regarding that, now that we know it's so important.
Yeah, I get some resistance. I would say that probably the biggest resistance I get is that I don't have an algorithm for people. I don't have a script. And it really makes people uncomfortable. Not all people, but a lot of people really do understand where I'm coming from when I say it, but this is very experiential. And it's going to vary based on the provider, based on the patient or the type of patient you're running on, the context, right? Like, what works for talking about, you know, grandma is not going to work for a SIDS patient. It's just not. And then the conditions of the family members on scene. I've been on scene where, you know, we've got a family member on the phone because we're doing a welfare check versus we've got 30 people. And now we've got a big scene and we've got a lot of emotions to manage. So it's just so different. And I'm not so removed from the field that I don't recognize that it's not going to be easy. And there's going to be challenges that I can't predict. So for me to teach something with that, I guess, that focused of direction, would have way too many blinders on for all the variables, right? So what I try and teach is the philosophies behind it, the why. I teach a lot of the why so that people can really recognize when they can plug in and utilize certain techniques, certain sayings, and then really just predict. I've heard this too, is that knowing why the family members were reacting the way they reacted relieved them of the guilt, knowing that they were just grieving and that this wasn't their fault. This wasn't something that they were just the messenger, right? And so that's been a big part of what I teach. And of course, yes, I do have I have an online course that goes through these things, and it has a lot of like PDFs, downloads, and I try and put things in cheat sheets, at least like something that's very quick, you know, for our short attention spans. But a lot of that stuff is available online as well that I post on my social media accounts. So if you have something specific, I'm more than happy to go over that right now too.
You go through, like you said, there's no specific approach, and that definitely makes sense. what would you do as like a, I know you've got to be empathetic and worry about like your body language and things like that when you are delivering the message really. Anything in your approach that would be kind of standard across each, you know, whether that be how you say things or the space you give the family, what you provide afterwards, anything like that.
Making contact with that family member, acknowledging who they are, telling them what you're doing and what's happening should happen immediately. Like, I mean, after ABCs are established, CABs and the team's going with that, where I work, usually the captain, cause it's, the fire department and the ambulance go to these calls. And so the captain will usually take the family aside, and start talking to them. And then after the paramedic gets everybody doing their roles, they could either step back and continue looking and coordinating everything, or they can take a moment to go make contact with that family member. And so I always tell people, go make contact with that family member, especially if you're going to be the one that ultimately tells them that there's nothing more that can be done. We're going to be stopping. You don't want your first point of contact to be when that time comes. You want to build that relationship up. So whoever's first in charge, to talk to them, let them know, you know, we have everything that the hospital does. We have the hospital on the phone if we need them. Because we have everything we need, we have a better chance of treating that. We are able to treat them immediately by not interrupting what we're doing, by getting to the hospital. We're going to be doing all this stuff here for 20 to 30 minutes, whatever it is. We will keep you updated and tell you everything you need to know. And you come and check in on them. And the thing is that a lot of times people don't want to give false hope, which is important, but you also don't want to, like, let's say you get pulses back. They're not out of the woodwork, you know, like they're not in the clear yet. So it's important to say, okay, we got pulses back. They are still unstable. There is no more unstable state than you were just dead, right? So even if you're seeing great vital signs, end tidal's good, we're having a great airway, you still want to let them know this is still a very serious situation. We're going to be continuing on stabilizing them, because even if they live, this is going to be a traumatic experience for them. So continue that train of support and including them in everything. And it's almost like hope for the best, but plan for the worst. It's kind of that attitude to have, but it's communication. It really is. If you do anything right on scene, it's to early communication and continuous communication with that family member.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, on the topic of communication, what would be, I know everyone always asks or says, you know, what if I say the wrong thing?
Then you do. Sorry. We're so scared of saying the wrong thing that we say nothing instead. And I'm so glad you said that. And I'm sorry I chimed in like that, but I want people to know that you're going to make a mistake. You're going to mess it up. You're going to walk away not feeling like you did your best. I want you to do it again anyways. And I want you to know that if you go in with the honest intention of just trying to support this person, you're already light years ahead of the person like me that just avoided them instead. So don't let fear talk you out of at least trying. And when all else fails, standing there with them, just letting them know that you're there and saying absolutely nothing, it's still a very powerful and supportive move.
What you spoke about at the start and now as well is continuing that support. And I think that's so important, because I feel like as paramedics or anyone in EMS, we're in such a position where we just want to do, like, we're doing interventions, we're doing skills, we're doing something. And it's kind of a situation where it's like sometimes doing nothing or doing less is more.
Yes. And it's so against what we are hardwired to do, which is someone has a problem, they call, we fix, right? If we can't fix it there, we take them to someone that's going to fix it. So we still come with a solution. And this is the first time we are being asked to do less, to stand down. That when somebody gets told that their husband of 40 years is now dead, they're going to break down and cry. And if we're not comfortable with emotion, we're going to feel like we need to fix this. This needs to, like, how do I fix it? I've actually been asked that. This person got told that their husband was dead. She broke down crying. Like, what do I do? And it's, the answer is very uncomfortable, and it's nothing. You allow. We need you to allow. She is grieving. She is starting her grieving process, and it is healthy what she is doing. And we have this idea that sadness and anger and depression and all the things that are on the opposite end of the spectrum of joy are bad, but they're necessary. They just are. And the only thing bad about those emotions is when they're interrupted and when they're suppressed. And so we need to remind the paramedic and the EMT as well, all levels of pre-hospital providers, that this, that you didn't fail by the patient dying. And this is where I think we get things wrong in our education system. For example, with where I teach, the students get during a mega code, they get built up to do a full CPR scenario. And they always get four rhythms, two forms of electrical therapy, and some sort of vasopressor drip, some sort of post-ROSC treatment that needs to be done. When all of our simulated patients live, what kind of programming, what kind of idea are we giving our students when it comes to real life? They will associate, and there's a lot of programs that will do this, ours included, was if you mess up on a skill, if you miss a dose, if you send the wrong defibrillation, the patient dies. It's associated with failure. And so I challenge any educator that's listening or any student that wants to take this back and say, hey, this is what she said, kill the patient. Let the student do everything right and kill the damn patient. Let them die. And let them get used to realizing that I can do everything right and this patient still lives. Because when we look at, it has not been done yet, but I would love to find out what percentage of paramedic programs are letting those simulated patients die in the event of a successful resuscitation attempt. They sound very opposite. And I even had one program administrator said, I was asking people, you know, how do you incorporate death notifications into your schooling, into your training? And they said, well, if a student makes an error, we force them to simulate what it would be like to tell the family that they died because they messed up. And I was like, no, please don't do that. But we have this unconscious association with failure. So then we feel bad. And we feel like we're doing something wrong. So that was a very long way to answer. I don't even remember what your question was, so I apologize. But hopefully that gave you some context of the importance of the way that we walk into that, is realizing that it's okay that we're not, our role isn't to fix their grief. Our role is to allow it to occur.
Yeah. And I mean, as you were saying that, there's a few thoughts that popped up as you were going through all of that. So like with the grief side of things, working in different areas in Australia with different sort of cultures as well, there's different cultural responses to grief and to death. And I think knowing that as well is really important as a paramedic or anyone in EMS, because, you know, you just, because one person cried and one person didn't, and, you know, different people experience grief in different ways, doesn't make it right or wrong. I think that was really important. And equally too, when you're talking about the programs, you'd like to see which programs do a full sort of successful attempt at a resus and then see the patient actually dying at the end. I'd love to see the ones that also engage and incorporate the attempt of doing a death notification at the end of it as well, and practicing that at university or in training.
Oh yeah, it needs to be done on a regular basis. And I saw this deficiency years ago. And in fact, that's actually what my my entire master's program was my graduate school was in death and grief, and I made all my focus on it was grief and bereavement, and my focus was on death and emergency workers, and just kind of how what this just learning about it and learning about its absence and realizing that, okay. And I kind of felt like I wanted to do it, but I felt like having a degree and having that background, I could really say without a doubt, this is something that was missing, because I want to change the standard. I want it to be part of our national curriculum. And I want it to be something that we look back and go, wow, how did we just not talk about this? You know, it's such a huge part of our job. And yeah, it's very important.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, we think about the family and the people on scene that are related to the patient, for example, like any friends or anything like that. And we always think about, I guess now we're talking about how our death notification will impact on them. But then we also got to think about, I guess, in a sense, you know, what we feel as paramedics and emergency responders when we've actually broken that bad news to them as well. Because I mean, I did three in a row, and the third of it, I was like, I can't do another one, not a fourth one, you know. So I mean, it's important to think about, I guess, what that impact has on yourself as well, giving that.
Yeah, and I think if you didn't know, imagine how many people have gone through their careers not realizing that was a legitimate thing to feel heavy about. That was a lot to carry. And when there's no acknowledgement towards it, you get stuck thinking it's only you.
Exactly. And when you're, 10 hours into a 12-hour shift and it's 4 o'clock in the morning and you've got other factors going, like all the barriers to that, I mean, you know, we don't think about it, I guess, either in our training for that sort of thing.
No, and I think, you know, I do think that the lack of direction, I hope that my course at least offers a foundation, but I tell anybody, especially the schools that I work with, that this is for your faculty to now take these fundamental philosophies and build something off of it and take their experiences with this, both personal and professional experiences, and integrate it into discussion in the classroom, integrate it into the skills, and let this be something that we talk about so often that it's less feared. Because I think that at the root of a lot of this avoidance is simply fear and this lack of education around it.
Absolutely. And I mean, I feel like we've had a pretty good conversation in terms of all of this, and whilst there's no exact way or method in doing it, I mean, what are sort of the underlying or fundamentals of delivering the death notification?
So one of them, like I said, would be to let them know right away what you're doing. Never ignore the family member. And there's always, you don't need to go around talking to all of them. I think it's kind of universally understood. You walk into a room or you walk into a house, you know who the what we call the shot caller is. You know who the person is who's in charge, who's second up or first up to be, you know, talked to. And you want to form a relationship with them, because that trust increases it does increase your scene safety, because you now have an ally in the person who is in charge in that household. And that has worked in my favor before. It's also worked out of my favor when I did not pay attention to that. But focus on building that communication with them. You want to make sure that you're giving them updates. Yeah, it's very obvious. I mean, it goes without say, but it's something that we really need to be mindful of the words we use. Their heart's not beating. We're pushing on their chest for them. This is helping to restart it. We are giving them medications in hopes that this helps it. We are, you know, delivering electricity or shocks with our monitor to reset the rhythm that they're in. We have a tube in their, you know, down their throat to help them breathe. You don't have to say, you using big words isn't going to make you sound any smarter. It's going to make them feel stupid, and it's going to make them clam up and not want to ask questions, right? It actually will create more of a disconnect. And then as far as the things that we say, a lot of what we say happens after the fact. And a lot of the things that we can say that could make things better or worse. Let me pull it up really quick, but I have a handout of Say This, Not That. The big thing I want people to think about when they're reading it, it's like on the left hand of the side, it's, you know, don't say this. And on the right hand, it says, say this, not that. We tend to want to say things like, be strong. I understand how you feel. You're going to be okay. They're in a better place. At least, you know, fill in the blank, or everything happens for a reason. And I think that the reason why we reach for those things is because when we were in a state of grief at one point in our lives, these are things that we told ourselves when we got to a state of acceptance that made us feel better. And when someone else is in distress and we're uncomfortable with that, or we feel the need to fix that, we try and offer this to them. And we try and, you know, offer it to them unconsciously, thinking that, well, it made me feel better, so maybe this will make you feel better. When in reality, only we could say those things to ourselves. And so while they're well-intended, the timing is not right. So there's better things to say. So for example, instead of telling someone to be strong, we can tell them, cry as much as you need. Because a lot of times some people feel like they're a burden to cry. It's too much to cry, or they're not getting, you know, whatever. So we want to encourage them, like, cry as much as you need. I talk a lot about, so when my mom died, that's where a lot of my story comes from. I'll tell the example of, like, I could run a call with an 18-year-old girl and a mother that just died suddenly. And it might be tempting to say that I understand how she feels, but the reality is I don't. We all have different backgrounds, circumstances, relationships, things that we're not going to see in the 30 minutes that we remain on scene with them. So instead, it's more appropriate to say, I can't imagine how you must feel. It's acknowledging that their grief is there, and that even though I don't know what to say, or I don't know how you might feel, simply acknowledging it can make that person feel very validated. And on top of that, it's okay to say, I wish I knew what to say, or I don't know what to say, or say nothing at all. One of the most impactful first responders that came when my mom died said nothing to me. And he's the most memorable one because he just stood there with me. He just made sure I wasn't alone. And that's all he had to do. He understood it. And so I like to remind people of that as well.
Hopefully that gives our listeners something to start looking into and to think about going forth, and when they are in their training, and potentially ask their prac tutor if they can do an example or a scenario where they are delivering a death notification, try and start utilizing these things, and if they're on placement, to start seeing how other people do it and sort of take points from that as well, and I guess come up with your own method, your own way, what you think you'd say and what you wouldn't want to say. And I think going to your page and having a look at all the handouts, because I mean, we could sit here and go through all of them all day, but obviously you've got your website and you've got your Instagram and everything, so I'll put all of those into the show notes so it's everyone can just easily click on it now, and that way they can go through and start seeing what they need or what they should be hopefully incorporating into their own sort of approach to death notifications.
Yeah, and please do, and please reshare them. I mean, I make them public for a reason. I want them to be shared. And I think the biggest thing I hope everybody takes away is, number one, you weren't taught this. And number two, the goal isn't for you to fix anything when you leave with them. It's like planting a seed to a tree that you're never going to sit under and enjoy its shade, but you're going to plant it anyways. Like, there's a saying that says something about that, is that, you know, plant seeds to trees you'll never sit under. I'm botching that. It's something along the lines, but you get the idea. Because when those first responders, those firefighters left our house, they left a house with a completely distraught family. Like, my whole family was there like that. There was a lot of us that lived in the same neighborhood, and you had two young daughters who now had no parent, a single mother. They did not leave thinking, we nailed it, we're good, they're going to be fine. Right? We were still in complete distress and shock. But it was their actions that directly contributed to the way that my sister and I grieved, aka healed. But they never left knowing that. You're never, and I say never very carefully, you're almost never going to get the feedback that you made the difference on that call. You're not going to get the immediate, you know, result. But I want you to do it anyways. And I want you to do it without condition of expecting it right there, because it's not going to happen. It's going to happen months later. It's going to happen years later. In my case, mom died over 20 years this year. Be 20 years. But look what I did with it, because of what they did for me.
That's incredible. And I mean, if anything, that just shows you the impact. So I really appreciate you coming on today and talking about this. And hopefully, like you said, this has impacted our listeners now, and hopefully one day, further people down the line, we might not even see that impact. But fingers crossed, it just continues to keep going. And I think it's so important now, the students that are listening to this, you're already a step ahead of where I was, and like you as well, Alex. And I mean, this is something that's so important. So I implore everyone to just start getting into this and have a look, and, you know, start with your course. I mean, that's a fantastic start as well. And other podcasts and research and things like that. So I really do appreciate you coming on. Is there anything you'd like to finish on, and if that you think you've missed, or where our listeners can find you as well?
The best place to find me is on Instagram. I'm on all the social media platforms, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, but Instagram is where I hang out most of the time. I like the community we have there. Emergency Resilience is where you can find my course. I'll have some additional courses coming out later this year. And yeah, I just want to just remind everybody, like, it's not something that, this is something we are pioneering together. We're learning together, and it's going to be with our collective voices that we're going to push the standard to finally pay attention to this deficiency.
That's awesome. I think we'll finish it off there, because it's a fantastic point to end on. And can't thank you enough for coming on today, Alex.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.